Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and you're very welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Frances Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Monday from 4 to 5. And during the show today, we'd love to hear from you, so please feel free to send us any questions or comments that you might have. You can get in touch with the show by text to 086 353 7782. Or you can phone the station and 776 2777 or email kitchengarden@crkc.ie and you can do that at any stage during the week. Now on the show today, as usual, we'll be bringing you the latest in food news from during the week, some seasonal recipes, and we'll remind you of some jobs to do in the garden around about now. And today we'll also be looking at food labelling, mushrooms, migration and manure. Mags.
Chat.
How was your week?
Yeah, another week of massive variation, the usual sort of carry on, exhilaration and stress and the whole lot. So, yeah, nothing strange, I suppose, and all that. I am kind of enjoying autumn, though. I like the change of season, actually, and it's nice. You know, the summer you spent all evening outside until it was dark. Now you're inside and I lit the fire one of the nights, and it's kind of nice, you know, just a nice change. So, yeah.
It is very autumnal now.
It is very autumnal, yeah. There's no chance of an Indian summer, I don't think, at this stage. We're past that.
Yep.
But
the 10-day forecast is showing maximum temperatures of about 16 degrees, so the days of sunbathing are gone,
I think. It's time to put the socks on.
It is. The woolly socks. And the ground is getting a bit damper now as well, so in jobs to do in the garden, we might talk about doing some planting now for the spring or planting some trees.
Yes. Yes.
Lawn repairs, it would be a timely time to do lawn repairs before it gets too wet.
Too muddy.
Exactly. Yeah. A busy week on the publishing front. I don't know whether you've had a chance to have a look at two books that came my way this week. One is, have you been watching the Jamie Oliver series, the new Jamie Oliver series?
I've only really started watching TV in the last week or so I haven't seen anything much.
It's really kind of back to the good old days of Jamie. I know he's had his troubles with the chain of restaurants and stuff in the UK, but his new series on Italy, Jamie Cooks Italy, where he visits all of the old nanas, all of the grannies around the various parts of various regions of Italy, is very, very good. It's really, really nice telly. And he does it with that Italian friend of his whose name escapes me at the moment. But there's an accompanying book with it.
Of course there is.
To help Jamie recover some of the 12 million that he had to reinvest of his own cash in the restaurant train. But it's really lovely.
Oh, okay.
It's a big, chunky book, loads of recipes in it, and at least half of the recipes that I flicked through so far, I would gladly cook myself at home.
And his stuff is quite easy. It's nothing too complicated.
I think he went a bit too far down the easy route with the last book, the five ingredients. Remember we reviewed that before last Christmas?
Yeah.
It was a dreadful book. Really dreadful. I cooked several recipes from it, and none of them worked. But this book is just no nonsense. I visited this place. I was inspired by these ingredients. Why don't you try this? A little old lady told me about this recipe. And then the team of people, of course, that he has working with him probably helped.
Together.
Yes. But it's beautifully shot and there's some fantastic recipes in it. One that I scribbled down last night, or actually folded down the page last night as I was watching the show, Stracato. A Tuscan recipe, and Tuscany, like, it's just so beautiful. He wanders around with the camera there, and it's hard to make the place look bad. It's just absolutely gorgeous. Real comfort food kind of stuff, slow cooked, cheap beef cut with a ragu in there. An 85-year-old woman kind of watching him as he chopped the veg for her, and she got really excited in her kitchen. Really, really lovely. And then there was a nice beef cheek recipe as well. Anyway. Highly recommended. I think it's a fantastic book. And another one, there's 140 recipes in that, actually, by the way. Mm. It's about £20. And then another book just released yesterday, my friend Gil Meller from River Cottage. His latest book, I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but I remember talking to him about it the last time he was over. It's called Time, T-I-M-E. And how he's kind of broken the book down is kind of like morning and daytime and nighttime and recipes that suit those times of the day. At the moment, it's on special on
like
Amazon.
Breakfast, dinner and tea sort of thing?
Pretty much, yeah.
That seems logical enough now, really, in fairness.
But one of the things he was kind of talking about was that time is an ingredient in all of the recipes that's often kind of not really considered. You know, the time of preparation or the time of cooking or the time of fermenting or whatever. That's a book that I'd really, really like to have a look at. It's on special on Amazon at the moment, but it's also available in the bookshops here in Kilkenny. And I'm hoping that we'll have a chat with Gil Mellor about that next week or the week after.
Well, I got a book today too.
Oh, well done.
From Liam from the show before us. Mm-hmm. And this one was first published in 1907.
Oh my God.
So not quite as recent as yours.
No.
But the author owned the Ritz in Paris.
Oh wow.
And Liam has obviously had it for a long time. Now when I say a cookery book, there's not one single photograph.
Yeah.
It's actually called, well there is of the author actually, Auguste Escoffier.
Oh, the Escoffier. Yeah, yes. Is it called
Gastronomic? A Complete Guide to the Art of Modern Cookery from 1907.
Very modern in 1907.
Not one single picture, but there's like, I've only just picked it up now, so I can't really type, but there's everything. Like there's pages of chicken recipes, but they're all really short. So it's obviously, you know, different sauces and bits and pieces. I think if you had this actually, well, this would probably keep you going for a long, long time. Like this recipe here, this page I've just opened, it's recipe 2965.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, Escoffier was like super, super famous. And I wonder, does that kind of presume you know a lot? Like, was that written for chefs, you know, or was that written for the home cook?
Well, compote of pineapple, which is 4,965, is peel a fresh pineapple, cut into slices, remove the hard core, poach in vanilla flavoured syrup. If using canned pineapple, drain and place the slices in syrup for 1 hour beforehand. Arrange the slices overlapping in a dish and cover with the syrup. It's okay, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't need
a lot of information, really, I suppose, do you?
Now, it'd be really interesting if you were to go through that in a bit more detail now and pull out a few recipes that...
Like this jam is done, you know, sometimes you could buy a whole book on jam. Well, jam is done here in about three pages.
And that's a big chunky book.
And there's cherry jam, plum jam, orange marmalade, rhubarb jam, apricot jam, tomato jam.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's once you have the basics, then you can kind of make up the rest yourself.
Isn't it funny how we've gotten used to cookery books being a visual treat as well as, you know, reference guides. And there's one now, it's just black and white, no pictures at all.
No.
Oh, I'd love to have a look at that.
Nearly after 600 pages.
My God.
Of thousands of recipes literally. So I don't need any more cookery books for a long, long time, I think. Some nice things though, like obviously very French, but yeah, I might I have a French woofer, as I was telling you about during the week.
Oh yeah.
But he doesn't actually know a lot about food, and bizarrely he doesn't drink red wine, which is delightful for me actually.
Where's he from?
Somewhere near Paris. But unusual, isn't it? For anyone, well, anyway, so, but he's done...
Does he smoke and have continuous affairs?
I don't know.
Are you sure he's
smoke.
French?
He's definitely French. But he's doing tremendous work, actually, so he's great.
Are you sure he's French?
But he did come woofing, so he came to work on a small holding without a pair of wellies. So I'm not sure he knew what exactly he was doing.
There's just too many possible French jokes there now.
He now has wellies.
Good. Oh, did you buy him wellies?
I bought him a pair of wellies,
very good, yeah. Very good.
Tracy's Hardware for €20.
20?
I think I'll get the value out of them, actually.
Right, okay. Will you just keep those as the official woofing wellies now?
And every woofer has to wear them. So everybody has to be size 42 from here on. But I had a box hedge, two kind of little box hedges out the back, and they were in lovely little mounds, little round, like little globes, I suppose. But they, over the years, they'd grown kind of wild, and they were just in square or rectangle. So I got him to, he's very neat actually, so I got him to re-round them, remould them, so they're absolutely perfect now.
Oh, yeah. He's out doing a bit of topiary.
Topiary,
fantastic.
Yes.
Brilliant.
I said now he could make the shape of France if he really wanted to, but he just stuck to the round.
I'm not convinced this lad is from France at all.
And he cleaned the shed the other day and restacked all of the wood. like someone said, does he have OCD? Like, it's absolutely perfect. And it's like, you know, going from large at the bottom up to small at the top, like, and the floor. But we'd never actually seen the floor before. Now you can see it. And it's immaculate.
Can I have a lend of him? How long is he here for? Does he want to stay for a year?
No, he wants to stay. He was going to stay for a week. He's now going to stay for 2 weeks.
And you're feeding him well?
I'm feeding him well, looking after him. So he seems to be happy.
Brilliant.
And I'm really trying, because he's here to learn English as well, you know, so to teach him English.
Are you not speaking French to him?
Oh, yes. We do little bits here and there. Yes.
What's your schoolgirl French?
Vocabulary mostly, actually, just to get by. There's been a little... you know, miscommunications, all right. He was letting out the hens and the geese one morning, but I actually forgot to tell him not to close the door after you've left them out.
Oh, they were all locked out then.
So they were locked out for the day. Now, not that they wanted to go in during the day, but that night there was a bit of confusion.
Right.
I was wondering why they hadn't gone in.
Right.
The doors were all locked. So isn't that, things like that.
But that's the thing about the animals. You assume a lot of knowledge, and somebody first to them like just doesn't have that.
And he was probably being careful in closing the doors, and you know, so. But yeah, it's interesting actually. The kids are quite enjoying having somebody in the house. I think he's into Star Wars. That's very handy for
the boys
small boy.
That.
Yeah, so there's great conversations.
In Fringlish.
Well, actually, it's more the kind of enact things. So that's handy. Yeah. So we're all learning dramas and things too.
This sounds fantastic. I can't wait to read your review on the Woof website about how this goes.
The funny thing is, he can review me, but I can't review him.
That's funny.
Yes, isn't
so
it?
So he reviews you as a host.
Yes.
Oh.
And the host reviews go up.
She made me work really hard.
Yeah, she wouldn't let me come indoors in the rain.
Oh, she bought me wellies that were too small. She said she could speak French.
So anyway, he's in town tonight for Culture Night.
Very good.
Yeah.
Actually, speaking of Culture Night, have you looked to see any of the things that are on tonight
in
Kilkenny?
Yes, great stuff on, actually.
There is some nice things on. I was looking at the Evening of Music, Prose and Poetry at the Heritage Council, the former Bishop's Palace. That looks nice.
Yeah.
And the Festival of Creative Making at the National Design and Craft Gallery. That's kind of in the yard there. It's always really good.
For kids.
Yeah, kids mostly. They get to print a bag or print a tea towel or that kind of stuff. There's always massive queues at that, actually, all of the various bits in there.
There's music on the parade. They were actually
setting up
when I earlier was coming through.
There's a gig on there from 5 until 10 o'clock tonight.
Yeah, different musicians.
The 7-inch Collective are on at 5 o'clock and they're back at 8 and they're playing lots of vinyl singles. The Unity Singers are on at 6 o'clock. The Rhyme Rag Ensemble Poets are on at 7. And then Karen Kane is on at 7:30. And then the 7-inch Collective are back at 8.
Kilkenny Castle is open tonight.
It's
really nice, isn't it?
Yeah. And the Medieval Mile Museum, I love that place.
Yeah, I think Roadhouse is open too. There's some nice
Roadhouse
things
is on
there
for some
too,
nice. But there's music on down at the Medieval Mile Museum from 6 to 8, and they're going to be. It's going to be. It says home to the sounds of ancient instruments and voices raised to the rafters, celebrating the long tradition of music on this site, from medieval verses to renowned evensong services. I really like the sound of that.
Yeah.
So I might pop down to the Medieval Mile Museum. The one thing I was kind of disappointed about, though, is for a county that has a great food tradition and heritage and loads of great producers and so on, there's no food-centric cultural event tonight.
There's not.
No, not anywhere. Now, there's one that I did see in Limerick at the Urban Co-op. Have you heard about the Urban Co-op?
Yeah.
So it started out as a kind of a buyer's club, basically, where you buy in bulk and then distribute. But they now have a massive big premises that they own, the co-op owned. It's owned, controlled and operated by its members. And it sells wholesome food at discount prices, essentially, because it kind of buys and produces in bulk. And they have an event tonight.
What's the event?
It's where they've invited, they've thrown the doors open to everybody. So anybody can come in and see what they do and see what's involved. And there's going to be music there from local artists and again some local poetry and all of that. It seems very community centric, this place. I was thinking we might give those a shout and have them
idea.
On the show.
Good idea.
But it was the one food event that kind of jumped out at me. None, sadly, in Kilkenny.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't wouldn't have thought of food as, of course, it was a huge part of our culture, but yeah. Maybe next year you could organise something.
Maybe next year we might do something, as part of the show. Now, we better take an ad break. And coming up after the ad break, today we're going to talk about mushrooms. I have some tips that I pulled together for people who may be going out. It's a great year for the edible shrooms. So anybody who's going out to do a bit of foraging, I have some tips here for them that they might like to hear. And then you have some recipes for us. And we may touch on food labels if there's time. And then there's some jobs to do in the garden. But you can get in touch out there if you wanted to ask us any questions or make any comments on the stuff that we're talking about. You can send us a text to 086 353 7782 or email kitchengarden@crkc.ie. And we'll be back just after these. You can email the show, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. And you're welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crow and Cottages, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from The Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5. So you can send in any questions or comments you might have to us by text on 086 353 7782 or email, like I said earlier, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Now, if anybody's been out wandering across the lawn or up in the field, wandering in any grassland or in woodland even, you may have noticed that it's mushroom time, and it's a great year for the mushrooms. There's lots and lots of them about. A great variety, of course. There's thousands and thousands of varieties of mushroom, most of which won't kill you but aren't particularly nice to eat. And there are a few which are truly delicious. And then, of course, at the other end of the spectrum, there's a few that are deadly poisonous. It's not possible on a radio show to give you a definitive guide to what you can and can't forage or eat. But I just thought I'd pull together a few tips on general tips for when you might go out and about collecting mushrooms. We had a fantastic day a couple of years ago, Mags, when we went out with the lads from Lavistown collecting mushrooms. And their course is coming up again on the 13th of October. Lavistown House, if you wanted to check out their website, lavistownhouse.ie, I think there's still places available on that. The beauty of that course is that Roger and Olivia take you out and you collect a sample of everything. So everybody collects all the mushrooms they find. Well, not all of them.
Well, the I found really nice about it was, before that, I would have just picked field mushrooms. Mm. But then they kind of give you confidence to check out others and a little bit of knowledge. And then you still need your own book, really, when you go out, because there's an awful lot of mushrooms and you do get confused with, you know, which is which. But it's a nice day out, really.
Yeah.
And you learn a little bit. But it is very pleasant wandering around woods, picking up mushrooms.
But the first tip, do you remember the first tip they gave us on that day when we headed out? They asked, had you brought along your own basket? And then Olivia went around with old newspapers, giving everybody a couple of sheets of newspaper so that you could divide your basket into two sections. And into one section, what you were absolutely convinced were edible mushrooms. And into the other section, never to touch against the edible mushrooms, were ones that you weren't sure about.
Yes.
And anything that went into that section, we weren't going to cook. Even if they later turned out to be edible, we wouldn't cook them because they were in contact with non-edible ones. And micrograms amounts of some of the mushrooms can really upset your belly.
Not many of them kill you.
I remember Roger explaining it as there's a spectrum of taste and goodness in the mushrooms. Everything from the few that are really, really delicious to the few that are deadly poisonous. And then in the middle, there's everything from it might not taste nice, to might upset your belly, to you might be in cramps, to you might be in hospital for a week or two.
So it is important to get it right.
It's very important to get it right. But I thought the idea of the two, either two baskets or the two sections in the basket was really, really good. If you're collecting lots of mushrooms to identify later. But most people, of course, will go out and they just want to pick the ones that are edible. So whenever I take anybody out for a bit of a mushroom hunt, the first question every time we spot any kind of mushroom is, can you eat that? So people want the ones that they can bring home to eat. Another thing that I noticed is the variation in the mushrooms during its life cycle. So lots of them start out looking very, very similar. They just look like the little button mushroom that you might buy in the supermarket. Some of them might have a sheath over the top or look like they're emerging from a sheath. The thing is, at that stage, it's almost impossible to tell lots and lots of varieties of mushroom apart. So it's never a great idea to pick them like that.
No, you want them to, you want them to develop a little bit as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, yeah, and look like the kind of mushroom that they will eventually become so that you can more easily identify them. Mm. Because one of the ones that comes out of, emerges from a little sheath like that and is perfectly white and, you know, looks absolutely lovely, is completely lethal.
That's the
nightcap.
Yeah, I actually saw one today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did.
See it?
On my road, just on an entrance.
Coming out of one of those little kind of, like it comes out of a pack, it emerges at the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing at the very start, but it is very, very, very poisonous. Mm. So when they're in that kind of a premature stage, leave them alone because you can't be sure what they're going to be. Another one, but that's the start of their kind of life cycle. They reach a peak where they're at their best, so the edible ones, and they don't last very long at that stage. So,
well, they don't last, and then the worms and the slugs and, you know, animals will stand on them or whatever if you're coming from a field. So you have to get out early in the morning, really, don't you, if you want to get the best of them.
You really do.
And I
actually got
a big donation last week because I'd gone out to a couple of the fields and found nothing, actually. And then last Saturday I got... Someone kindly gave me a big box of mushrooms that they'd picked and weren't going to use. So I made mushroom soup, mushroom and thyme soup, and then I made marsala chicken with wild mushrooms.
Oh, which is sounds
delicious.
Lovely.
Yeah, I can go through those recipes. But
oh, you have those in with you. Excellent.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
And samples of the soup? And
No, the soup was well gone, I'm afraid. Now, I did give back some to my donor, but the chicken was all eaten, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. But... they don't last at that kind of peak ripeness for very long. So I came across a horse mushroom in the field, massive, like a field mushroom, but really, really big, dinner plate size, the other day when I was out feeding the animals. And I thought, that's absolutely perfect. I'll come back and get that later. In the space of a day, it had just gone all dark and just not very appetizing.
They don't
anymore.
Look appetizing then.
No,
they don't. No, no.
So,
but also the worms get into them very quickly.
It's true. You have to give them all a bit of a shake. And often you'll find kind of like the slugs have had a nibble out of them and so on. And there's a myth, there's a lot of myths around kind of mushrooms, but some people have tried to coin shortcuts to learning what's edible. And so one of the myths is if an animal has had a nibble at it or a slug has had a nibble at it, then it's fine to eat. That's absolute nonsense.
Oh, I've never heard that one.
No, it's just absolute nonsense. Those creatures can get away with stuff that we can't. And maybe they don't get away with it. Maybe the slug later went on to die.
They do eat pellets as well, don't they?
A very good point. So look for them when they're at their absolute best and use them straight away. And the best example, I think, of that is the shaggy ink cap.
Oh, yeah.
That's the long, phallic-looking mushroom, really. Pops up in a day. It lasts just a day, beautiful and white, and then it starts to darken from the bottom and it works up the cone of the mushroom very, very quickly. But if you pick one of those, even when it's at its firmest and its brightest white, bring it home, within an hour it's gone soft and it's starting to turn to mush. Within 2 hours it's gone black, any of the pink bits have kind of turned black, and after kind of 3 hours you just wouldn't want to cook with it. So there's a reason why most of them aren't available in the supermarkets. They just don't last.
They don't last, yeah. I suppose they appear really quickly and then they're gone very quickly.
Yeah. The shaggy ink cap, very, very easy one to identify if people wanted to have a look on our Twitter. I'm going to tweet some pictures of it. You can see lots of photographs of them online. But it's a tall white mushroom, kind of cylindrical in shape. But it reminds me that the golden rule when you're picking mushrooms is that you have to be absolutely sure of what you're picking, because a few of them do have lookalikes that aren't as nice. That one is fairly bomb-proof. The horse mushroom is fairly bomb-proof as well. There are some others, like the seps, the morels, that they do have kind of lookalikes that you really have to be sure of what you're at. So get yourself a good
Roger
book.
Roger Phillips, isn't that the guide? That's quite a good book.
Yeah, Roger. Whenever
and if in doubt, just leave it out.
Leave it out, exactly. But whenever you buy a book on mushroom identification, I have a few now, and you get one, it's like, oh, this is 4,000 mushrooms in it. Excellent. That's a great one. And then shortly thereafter, oh, here's one with 12,000.
Yeah.
So what were the 8 that you were missing in the previous book, you know? And the more you know, the more you realise there is to know. it's a huge, huge area to study. But when you're identifying them, a few things that help you identify, apart from just the way it looks, because a lot of them can look very similar, the smell of the mushroom is very important. So
where it grows, I think, is really handy one.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Look, when you're looking at the mushroom, don't just look down, look up. So what's over you? What's the tree that you're beside? And what
some will only grow beside beach, or some will only grow on whatever, mossy ground or whatever. So
It's brilliant
habitat, really.
But they do have a kind of synergy with some trees. You're absolutely right. So if you look at the tree that it's underneath, and all of the book guides, if they're specific to a particular tree, it'll mention that tree, so that'll help you kind of narrow it down. The smell is very important, so some of them would have like an almond smell or an earthy smell, and again they tend to be mentioned in the guides. And then of course the shape of the mushroom, but then the shape of the gills or pores that are underneath the cap of the mushroom. So some of them have gills that run all the way out from center to
and
the
where
edge.
The gills actually meet the stem.
Yes.
That's a really useful one. And how the gills form, if they go run from center the whole way out, or if they cross over, or if they link in with others.
Or they form.
I studied this stuff in college. And it's funny, sometimes like, you think you've forgotten everything, but it comes back every
comes
now
back
and then.
To, yeah, when you're,
yeah, in
when
moments,
you're possibly,
oh,
going to, possibly going to poison yourself.
Yeah.
But the one that I love doing with the kids is it'll often tell you the spore colour. Now, looking at the mushroom, you can't tell what colour the spores are that are inside that mushroom. There's billions and billions and billions of them, but they're all very tiny. But you can make a spore print. A fantastic thing to do. So you put the mushroom upside down with the spores facing down, or the pores facing down. Not all mushrooms have spores. On a piece of white paper. And maybe cover it then with a glass bowl or some kind of bowl so that wind doesn't disturb it and people don't knock against it. Leave it there for just a couple of hours, and when you come back and lift up the mushroom, the spores will have dropped out of the pores or the gills, and you'll see the print for that particular mushroom.
That's a nice thing to do.
It is. It's lovely. Yeah. It's a really lovely thing to do. So you can see the colour of the spores that are inside there. That'll help with the identification, the pattern that they're in, and it's just good fun to do. It's just a nice thing to do. So there's lots and lots that are out there, and if you're going, if you are, you've identified them, you've given them a bit of a clean, you've brought them home, use them as quickly as you can. But if you do need to store them in paper, not in plastic. They don't like living in plastic. They go to mush in.
They just don't last very long.
No.
Bring them in and use them.
Use them straight.
Some people don't bother about the little worms that go up the stalks and into them. They just use them. I'm not particularly finicky about lots of things, but I don't really like worms.
No.
I do filter
clean.
Those ones out.
Yeah.
Like, that's the first thing I'll do when I pick them up to check them.
I got a present last year of a mushroom forager's knife. And it's a lovely thing with a sharp little blade at one end. And on the other end is a little stiff bristled brush. So you can kind of brush off the bits of dirt and stuff the top of your mushroom. And some of the insects that like to take up residence inside as well.
Yeah, you do get some little bits, but not that many actually, don't.
But I'd like to get, I always like to kind of chop them up and use them as quickly as I can. And the best friend of mushrooms, I think, is garlic. Just if you're going to fry them up with a little garlic, absolutely delicious.
And thyme.
Thyme is,
I think it's just match made in heaven. Mm. I think it's perfect.
But there's a lovely dish that I like to make, particularly with the shaggy incaps, so the most easily identifiable of all of them. And I just chop up the shaggy incap, fry them in a little butter with a little garlic, pop that just for a minute, pop that in the bottom of a ramekin, a buttered ramekin, pop in an egg on top into the oven for 2 or 3 minutes, a hot oven. And then you've that beautiful eggy, mushroomy, garlicky mix. It's a delicious breakfast. Really, really nice. But you've got some recipes there for...
Well, mushroom soup, like, you can't really go wrong. And I have my soup recipe, which I've talked about here a couple of times, is just a cup of potato, a cup of onion, and then 3 cups of your vegetable. So this is what I did for my last, when I got the mushrooms last week.
So hang on, give us that again, that
cup
breakdown.
Cup of potato.
Cup of potato.
Cup of onion.
Yeah.
And then 3 cups of your vegetable.
Okay,
so
that's your basic mushroom.
My basic
Or sorry, your
soup.
Basic soup mix.
Yeah. Then you can add in whatever, you know, you want to put in, ginger or garlic or whatever and stuff, but that's the basic. I didn't put garlic in the mushroom soup actually. Sautéed the onion and the potato, added in the mushrooms. I put in, I kind of had a little bit more than 3 cups, to be honest, for that, so I put in a bit more. And added in the mushrooms, lots of pepper and salt, and then added in some stock. And let it cook for another couple of minutes until everything was nice and soft, and then I added in thyme. And I did add a little bit of yogurt just for serving. And I did chop in some chives, because I just felt like it, to be honest, and they're nice and green.
Are you showing off for the Frenchman? We're all about our presentation.
No, he hadn't arrived, so it wasn't for him. But, and it was really lovely soup, like made in minutes, and like it was for very little money, really, you know. So.
And that was with field mushrooms?
Field mushrooms, yeah. I do tend to clean off the kind of, you know, the loose skin at the top of them, and took the stalks off, so, and just checked for worms. So there was no worms in my soup. I have been fed soup in the past that I afterwards knew there was probably worms in it, so, a long time ago, but anyway. But then I have another recipe that I've actually used quite a few times, actually. It's called marsala chicken with wild mushrooms. So you need, I tend to use chicken breast on the bone, with the skin on and everything. So just lightly coat the chicken with seasoned flour, a little bit of pepper and salt in it, and then in a heavy pan saute it in butter for a couple of minutes on both sides, just until it starts to turn golden. Then you want to remove the chicken, add the marsala, and allow it to bubble for a minute, just to burn off the alcohol. Then pour the chicken and the marsala into your pot that you're going to cook it in. Add the herbs to that and the with your herbs. Sorry, I actually forgot the ingredients. I'm just going to go through the ingredients. Okay, so you need chicken, then some seasoned flour, which is just flour with salt and pepper, some olive oil, a little bit of butter, 1 to 2 tablespoons of marsala, 500 to 600 mils of chicken stock, some thyme leaves, and some wild mushrooms, about 300 grams of wild mushrooms, and 250 grams of creme fraiche.
And if you don't go out and pick your own wild mushrooms, increasingly there are some varieties available in the supermarkets.
Some kind of mixes and that at times. Yeah,
and there dried are. Ones as well.
Yeah, the dried ones work perfectly fine too. So
rehydrate them in kind of some warm water.
Yeah. So you've cooked the chicken, so you've just fried the chicken off for a couple of minutes, and then you add the marsala, let that bubble for a few minutes, pour enough stock then over your chicken and your marsala. Then bring that to just a simmer, add the herbs, and then cover and leave it on the hob for about 20 minutes to cook. So once your chicken is cooked through, in the meanwhile, then in the frying pan that you were using earlier, fry your mushrooms just for 4 or 6 minutes, and then you want to put the chicken and your juices and everything into a nice serving dish. Put the mushrooms on top, lots of parsley, and a little bit of creme fraiche. It doesn't sound great. It's really tasty. My kids adore it.
It doesn't sound great. Just told us.
No. I've gone through a bottle of marsala in no time, because it's just it's a favourite actually in our house.
I love really the nice. Sound of that.
Yeah, it
that
is.
That sounds
really
great.
Really tasty.
Did you bring any in?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
No,
there's
I didn't.
No smell of chicken marsala
no,
in
no,
here.
It's really nice. And serve it with potatoes. It's actually just boiled potatoes or mashed potatoes, or you could serve it with rice if you wanted to, and some kind of green vegetables. Yeah, if you've buckets of runner beans, you could have some runner beans and butter.
Use them up.
Yeah. It's a nice dinner.
Really
nice dinner.
And we'll put that recipe up now. We'll tweet that with you're going to send that to me by Monday, and we'll tweet that along with the podcast of the show.
Yep.
Excellent. Right, well, we're just going to take a short break, and then coming up after the break, you're going to tell us all about migration.
I might tell you a few things about migration.
This week's Nature Notes. We'll have migration and then some jobs to do in the garden. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Text us on 086 353 7782.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crow and Cottages here in Kilkenny, and I'm with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery out in Thomastown. We're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5, and we'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us by text to 086-353-7782, or you can email the show, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. There's a text in during the break there, Mags. Don't pick them all. I think it says it all. If you're out picking mushrooms, don't pick everything that's in front of you. Just take, generally, the foraging rule is pick a third and leave the rest.
Yeah, kind of pick what you're going to use. Yeah. Like, you're not going to eat, like, mushrooms morning, noon and night.
Absolutely, and they won't keep.
No.
But remember the spot where you picked them, because they come back in that spot year after year after year. There is a spot in the field out of Croan where the horse mushrooms grow. And there is another spot where two rings of fairy ring champignon grow. And there's another spot where the field mushrooms grow. And the spot just at the gate where the shaggy incaps grow.
Yeah.
And so there's their mycelium live, that's the actual body of the mushroom. So the mushroom itself is only the fruiting part of it. The main part of the mushroom is under the ground.
Creeping around the ground.
Yeah, and into the trees and under grass and so on. And that's where that lives. But it will fruit in the same place every year. So thank you to that texter. You're absolutely right. Don't pick everything in front of you. Generally pick a third and leave the two thirds. Now, migration.
Well, time of the year for it, really, isn't it?
It is.
Birds in, birds out.
I was looking for my swallows today. I think
they're gone. Yeah, mine are gone. Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah, sad. But, you know, it's kind of part of the cycle, isn't it?
Mm.
But, of course, birds are not the only ones to migrate. And swallows are definitely not the only ones to migrate. Fish do. You know, salmon will move to spawning grounds and trout will too. Butterflies in America. Yeah. You know, the monarch butterfly that flies. Like, imagine the size of the little thing. Well, I know they're sizable butterflies, but even still, they fly from, like, northern America the whole way to Mexico for the winter.
That's amazing.
That is quite amazing. I've seen them on TV a couple of times, just the journey and that. Quite amazing. They stop off for breaks and everything along the way, but it is quite amazing. But I suppose here in this country, it's birds that migrate. It's different types of migration. Partial migration, and there's molt migration. Shell ducks migrate, but they stop. We don't have that many shell ducks in this country, but quite common in the UK. They stop in a place in Somerset for a little while and they have their molt. And then they head,
They get organised and then they head on again.
Yeah, in a particular location. So it's one of the world's most extraordinary wonders, really, if you think about it. And all the thousands and millions of birds that are crisscrossing the globe every year. And, you know, they spend I don't know how long it takes some of them and stuff, but they travel for thousands of miles and then travel back again. Some of them don't go on exactly the same route there and back. They take slightly different route depending on availability of food, really, mostly. The main ones we'd kind of be really common with here are the cuckoo, the swallows, swifts, house martins, sand martins. They all travel south to Africa.
Mm.
And then we'd have a lot of spotted flycatcher as well, as one that travels south. But we'd have a lot then that come from Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, Iceland, Greenland, and they come here for the winter. So the whole idea of migration really is all about survival.
Yeah.
So they're just moving somewhere where they reckon they can, they'll have better food or
better weather
and a better place to breed. But that's the breeding is all really associated with food, the availability of food. So you know, you'd wonder why the swallows would come here, and then it's like they arrive in April and stuff, and the weather is awful. But there's still better food, so that's why they come. They reckon like migration has been around for thousands of years. They reckon it kind of might have started after the Ice Age, where, you know, new territory was being opened up, so animals were able to kind of expand their ranges, and they would have moved, and then might have gotten a bit colder and stuff, and moved back, and then they developed
a pattern.
Yeah, but it's kind of it's in their genes now. It's on the genetic print, because cuckoos. I remember we mentioned this back during the summer when I was talking about cuckoos. They leave earlier than their offspring, so these little cuckoos have never known anywhere except Kilkenny or Wexford or wherever, and they head to Africa by themselves. Their parents have gone before them, but they know, first of all, they know to do it, and they know how to get there, which is quite amazing.
It is really amazing. And they don't it's not like Mammy and Daddy Cook who come by and like tell it, listen, we'll see you back in Africa, so just head over that way and then turn right at France, you know.
No, but they're it's kind of controlled. Well, you know, you'll see the swallows like in the last couple of weeks getting a bit restless, and they're all gathering and they're all chittering and chattering. And I saw a lot of them kind of on the roof of a house just down the road, and they were just like skittering and scattering up and down. They kind of, their glands sort of develop a restlessness, which is triggered by the change in climate, the change in the length of the day, the change in the weather, the change in temperatures, change in the length of day. So they kind of develop this restlessness, and that's when they start to want to go. But they've shown studies of migratory birds who are now kept in cages, and every spring and autumn they'll develop sort of a restlessness, even right. though they were maybe born in captivity and
stuff.
But they'll develop a restlessness, and they'll start, you know, keep flying towards maybe one side of the cage or something, because it's inbuilt in them. It's part of their genetic makeup now.
Going.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, it is quite amazing, isn't it?
It is incredible.
And a lot of, sometimes, particularly with like the summer visitors here that would leave, they'll kind of wait for a period of maybe settled weather, and then they'll head off. So they don't head off in the middle of a storm. I suppose that makes sense, doesn't it? And when the birds are flying oversea, they just go north-south. They're going straight, you know, in a direction. They know the direction they're going in. But on land, they kind of, they'll have their landmarks, and they'll go from place to place, and they'll stop off in different locations.
I always think it's amazing that we can understand this now on a kind of global scale, because, you know, scientists are talking to each other. We've modern communications. We can track these things. Larger birds can have little sat-nav devices kind of attached to them and send back information to us. Just a few generations ago, this must have been completely mysterious. So just a couple of hundred years ago, they must have been wondering, where does everybody go?
200 years ago, they thought the swallows hibernated. Or just over 200, yeah, because they suddenly vanished.
Yeah.
And in some part of there was this theory that they went into the reeds, and they vanished in the reeds, but they were kind of just on their way, you know, on the coast, I suppose. So they were going, and then when they were cutting the reeds and stuff, so a couple of swallows might have been found dead.
Right.
So they thought, yes, they're definitely
hiding in the reeds.
Well, they thought they were actually hiding in the mud in the reeds, first of all, but no, they weren't. And Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, he thought that red starts, which are a little garden-y looking bird with a kind of a red on their side of their breast, not that like robins, but he thought red starts turned into robins.
Right.
Because red starts come here in the winter and then they leave again. And robins can move as well, actually. So there's lots of birds that do kind of a...
The European robin comes to visit us in Ireland, doesn't he?
Yeah, but see, a lot like wagtails and couple of the kind of the more common birds and stuff, they're not going to nest. They'll move if the weather is bad, or if maybe they think it's going to be bad and stuff, they'll move sort of south and west or east, just for a slightly easier winter for survival. Yeah, yeah, it's quite amazing, isn't it?
Isn't there a story around the barnacle goose that they thought they saw the barnacles, and at a different time of the year when they saw the goose, and they thought one turned into the other? Or something
maybe something similar to the red start and the robin. Yeah. Aristotle.
Although,
yeah, I thought he was very clever, wasn't
quite
he?
Like dramatic, the yeah.
So this partial migrate, and you know, starlings, some do, some don't. I don't know why they do or don't, but so some will take off and some won't.
And there's no genetic difference between the ones
do.
Wow, some are just lazy. And
yeah, maybe, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, we've like passage migrants. So you'll hear talk generally in the spring of, you know, such an exotic species and stuff has landed in Wexford, and all the Twitterers are out photographing it and that. So they're just birds that'll maybe stay for, but they might stay for a week or a month or whatever. And the Wexford Nature Reserve and the North Slob and stuff is a great place for, it's kind of set up for that and stuff, but they'd have huge numbers of passage migrants and stuff, which are quite exciting. If you've never seen them before, you can go and have a look at them. And also, that's The slobs would hold huge populations of geese, wintering geese, and they would literally just graze and graze and graze the winter cornfields
those,
and the grass.
Those habitats, like the slobs and the mud banks and stuff, they're not very romantic kind of habitats, but so important.
So important. Really nice to visit, actually. Mm. I haven't been there for a couple of years, but
if you're looking at the birds, not necessarily if you're looking at the
birds. Well, sorry, the hydrology of the slobs is very impressive because it was drained. Mm. So, and there's all the wall and everything. So there's a little bit now that would interest you actually there. So there's nice construction actually, and pump house and all that sort of thing. Right. Yeah, so it's not just kind of flat fields and geese.
The Dublin Bay, the estuary at Dublin Bay, after they built the causeway over to Bull Island, it started to fill with sediment. Mm. So Dublin Bay is full of sediment. The Liffey carries down millions of tons of it. And most of Dublin Bay around where Kilbarrick, where I grew up, was slowly filling in. So it gets water now for like half an hour at high tide, where, you know, it used to be water all of the time. But those mud banks are just filled with birds. Curlew was a sound of my childhood. Like they used to spend a lot of time there, I know. But loads of migratory birds, and not just down on the mud. I don't know whether it was because we were beside the bay or whatever, but on the football pitch across the road from my house, Canada geese used to spend the winter
and
there.
Brent geese, I think, yeah.
Amazing stuff, amazing. But it's funny you talk about not anymore with the curlew, because these patterns of migration have been spotted over the generations, haven't they? And people do exploit them to kind of catch the birds, unfortunately, for the table.
And there's lots of kind of predators on the way and starvation. And, you know, in fairness, it's a big journey for a tiny little bird. And some of them will fly in flocks, but some of the swallows just take off by themselves, actually. You think they're all going together, but they just go at the same. But they're not really, they're not flying as a group. Not like the geese who will fly in formation and they protect each other and they come as a group.
It's a more efficient way for them to fly. They pass on a bit of lift to each other.
Yeah, they're breaking the wind and everything and stuff. And they take turns. So whoever's up front then gets a turn at the back, and they keep swapping. Like that's very developed, isn't it? Really.
I bet you there's one that just hangs out down the back all the time and never takes his turn up the front. There's always one. Like
is there? I don't know. The Brent geese, though, they come from northern Canada, kind of towards the Arctic, and they're very important, actually, because most of them winter in Ireland. Oh. Very few go to Britain, and a few go to France. But and there's a couple of sites. One big one in the north and Wexford, and a couple of other sites. And I know I worked on a site up in Louth a long, long time ago in another, and this farmer, now he was a very big farmer that everybody, a very well-known farmer, but I won't mention his name, but he actually, in fairness, donated, 24 or 25 acres of winter corn to the geese, actually.
My God.
And he let them there, yeah.
That must have been hugely important to, like, the population of the geese.
Yeah, well, he could have had 8,000 maybe there, you know, so.
That's a huge amount. There's a text in, don't forget the whales. And, of course, Ireland is a famous spot for the migration of the whales.
And the whales have kind of spending more time hanging around, actually, along the south coast. Cork has had, I actually did some whale watching a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, has had huge numbers of like minke whale, humpback whales, and sperm whales. I'm not sure about sperm, but minke and humpback definitely. And they've spent much longer here than they would have had in past times. They would have really just passed along. But whales and like animals migrate too. Reindeers, the wildebeest in the Serengeti and stuff. You've probably all seen programs on those and stuff. They take off and like travel miles. And it's all about food and breeding. But it's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
It really is. It's fascinating how it kind of happens, how they map out these routes, how they pass it on to the next generation and stuff. It's fascinating stuff. But thanks a million for all of that. That was brilliant.
I could talk on for another 10 minutes.
Well,
but
unfortunately,
anyway.
We want to give people some jobs to do in the garden, and we're going to be running short of time today. So some of the jobs, not too many heavy lifting ones, but if you haven't clipped your hedges, now is the time to kind of give them their final clip.
Get a woofer.
Get a woofer. Get a French woofer in to make all of your hedges into globes. But now's the time to do it. So that was very well timed, actually, getting your hedges done. Well done.
That's me, yeah.
Very organised. Get your spring bulbs into the ground as soon as possible. So there's loads of value in the supermarkets and in the garden centres at the moment. You'll get bulbs now for half price and even less because they're anxious to be shot of them out of the shop. So get your narcissus and your daffodils and so on. Get them, the spring bulbs, all
well,
into
I
the
bought
ground now.
60 tulips last week, actually.
Wow.
So hopefully they'll go in on Monday.
They're the hardest of all the bulbs to plant, you know that? They have to go down deeper than all of the rest because the stems need support for that big, heavy flower on the top. Are you going to get the woofer to do that as well?
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. If you,
I will help him.
Well, show him how to do it right. There's no point in putting a tulip in shallow.
Oh, I know,
It'll just fall over. The rest of them you can kind of get away with, so like any of the cyclamen or any of that kind of stuff, really, really shallow. Generally, it's kind of twice the depth of the bulb itself.
Yeah.
But with tulips, I'd go three times.
But the ground is nice and soft now. It's kind of nice. It's easy digging now at the moment, in fairness. Yeah. So.
And I love planting bulbs because... It kind of speaks of springtime.
It does, it's planning, it's hoping.
Yeah, waiting for them to kind of come up. If you wanted to do any sowing a grass seed, now is an ideal time to do it. So get that down onto any bare patches on the lawn, or if you're sowing a new lawn or doing any repairs, now is the time to do that. Plant some of your spring cabbage into the ground. So anything that you've taken the potatoes out of, an ideal spot for the cabbage to go in. Shouldn't need any fertilizer because the potatoes... would have gotten a good bit before they went in.
Yeah, I saw spring cabbage actually for sale in some of the garden centres actually last week.
Yeah, now's the time. Yeah. But you'll still need to protect them for the next couple of weeks in case there's any...
pigeons.
Yeah, pigeons and stuff around. They will have them over the winter. They just love that. They love the brassicas. And then, of course, in the garden, there's lots of tidying up around now to be doing. So any of the kind of, a lot of stuff has kind of gone to seed or just gone over. Weeds have grown aplenty in the last few weeks.
Oh, my sunflowers actually just collapsed with the storm this week.
I still have some left out in the garden with the seed heads hanging, and I can see the birds on them taking the seeds. It's like giant feeders up there. And one, I've saved some seed from... No, I'm not exaggerating. The flower on the on this was almost 60 centimetres across, like almost 2 feet of flower. It was enormous. The biggest sunflower I've ever grown. And do you think I got a good photograph of it? No, of course I didn't.
And this was a great, my best year for sunflowers, actually.
Super. Right, well, pick your apples and start to pick your pears before they're all blown onto the ground. Of course, the pears need some time off the tree in order to ripen. But if they've hit the ground first... they're not much good. Now, we better leave it at that. We've run out of time. We don't have time for that lovely song that you were looking forward to, Ed Sheeran's Autumn Leaves.
It's okay.
We'll be back. We hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back at the same time next week from 4 to 5 on Friday Live, and the show is repeated on Monday from 4 to 5. You can stay in touch during the week on Twitter at Nesbitt F or at